dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week I'm going to take a break from our ongoing reading of Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, in order to bring you a body of material related to the themes we've been raising. This week, dealing specifically with social equality, culture, food, and farming. For all this audio, I have to thank Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters in Seattle. We'll begin with an interview he conducted.
Richard Wilkinson studied economic history at the London School of Economics before training in epidemiology and is professor emeritus at the University of Nottingham Medical School and honorary professor at University College London. And he is co-author, along with Kate Pickett, of the new book, The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Stronger. Richard, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
So start out and tell us, what was your motivation in writing your new book, The Spirit Level, and maybe include where the title comes from?
Well, first the title. In terms of the American markets, I think the title is a silly mistake. We couldn't think of a title for our book. I spent a long time worrying about it. Then the publisher decided that because our book contains a number of graphs with sloping lines and so on, and we're talking about income differences, leveling and so on, they suggested the spirit level, which in Britain means the carpenter's level, you know, with a little tube and a bubble in it. But I didn't realize that Americans just call that a level or a carpenter's level. You don't use the term spirit level. So it doesn't mean much to American audiences. Why did we write it? Well, I've been working for a very long time on a tendency for more equal countries with small income differences between rich and poor to have better overall health, longer life expectancy, for instance. And we'd slowly realized that this was a pattern not just confined to health, but, for instance, it's also true of homicides and things like trust and social cohesion. They're all stronger, and the outcomes are worse in more unequal societies. And I'd written several times on this kind of stuff, but then we found that actually that picture applies also to mental illness, to obesity, to drug abuse, to child well-being, to teenage birth rates, a whole range of problems that we all know are more common in the poorest areas of our society, but we find they're much more common in more unequal societies as well. And I suppose that, you know, I started to feel really confident of this picture about the time I retired. And so I've really moved from thinking about research to something closer to campaigning. You know, in a way, research is about doubt and not knowing, whereas campaigning you can only do if you're really confident of a picture. And it just happened that we became confident that nearly all this picture must be right, even if we've got some minor details wrong. So the book was one last shot at getting it onto the public agenda, making politicians think about it, and so on.
All right. So tell us how you, what data you looked at, and what the conclusions were.
Yes. Well, at first we did the analysis just looking at the rich developed countries. We wanted countries which, in a way, have got to the end of the benefits of economic growth. And people don't realize it. And because we all want more money, people think that economic growth is beneficial. But it's no longer beneficial if you look at population life expectancy, or if you look at levels of happiness or levels of well-being. Growth matters still very much in poorer countries, but amongst the, you know, European Union countries, USA, Japan, Australia, countries like that, growth doesn't bring the real social benefits that it used to any longer. We've got enough of everything, so it doesn't make much difference. So we were looking at those countries that have got to the end of economic growth. I mean, basically, we took the 50 richest countries in the world, threw out the ones with less than 3 million population, because we didn't want tax havens like the Cayman Islands and all that sort of stuff, and then looked at the rest for which there is good data where you can compare the scale of income differences in different societies. So we did most of the analysis on those countries. But then we found the results so surprising that we tested it out independently on the 50 states. And what we found in the countries was that the more equal countries with smaller differences between rich and poor did better on a whole range of problems. I mean, I mentioned some of them, but let me run through the list again. I always have to write it down because I can't remember all the different things that are worse in more unequal societies. Homicide rates, life expectancy, mental illness, obesity, drug abuse, levels of trust, social cohesion, child well-being, teenage birth rates, all sorts of things like that are worse. So we checked it out to see if that was also true amongst the 50 states of the USA. There's a sort of quite independent test bed. And found exactly the same story. I suppose that, you know, made me really determined that we should get this onto the public agenda, make sure people do know about it. And in a way, what we're talking about is the real quality of life for human beings. I mean, all these problems are ones that worry people a lot. Oh, actually, I forgot one of them. It's imprisonment. The proportion of the population in prison in more and less equal countries differs radically. And these problems are not just a little bit more common in more unequal countries. In a comparison people did of American states and Canadian provinces, you find the most unequal ones have homicide rates 10 times as high as the most equal American states or Canadian provinces. We find, looking at it internationally, slightly smaller differences, but still closely related to inequality. And if you take something like teenage birth rates, there's similar huge differences. Even mental illness, there's sort of threefold differences between how well and badly more and less equal countries do. Really important.
How do you define inequality? How did you come up with numbers for that?
Well, what we've done is take the scale of income differences. The measure we used, simply because it's available, you can download it from the World Bank or the United Nations websites, is how much richer are the top 20% in each country than the bottom 20%. And in the most equal of the advanced market democracies, countries like Japan, Finland, Sweden, Norway, they're 3.5 or 4 times as rich, the top 20% compared to the top bottom 20% in each of those countries. Whereas in Britain, the USA, Portugal, Singapore, it's 7, 7.5, even 8.5 times as rich. So we're almost twice as unequal as the more equal of the rich market democracies. And so in a way, what we were doing was just looking at the implications of those differences in the scale of inequality.
And then the data on the different countries themselves, where does that actually come from?
All sorts of sources. I mean, the health and mental illness comes from the World Health Organization. Data on drugs comes from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. Homicide, I think, was also World Health. I can't remember all of them. There's data on trust from the World Values Survey. Amongst the American states, we're nearly always using American government data. Always we use the most reputable sources we can find. And we also have a rule that we don't pick and choose the data. And that's really important because you could make any thing stand up if you did that. So we take all the data there is, warts and all.
All right. And then countries like India and China, you didn't include them from...
They're not amongst the 50 richest in the world that we were interested in. And in those countries, economic growth is still really important. You know, it still does lead to increases in life expectancy and happiness and so on. It's only amongst in the rich world that's no longer true.
How does one measure happiness? What is that?
No, there are questionnaires on that. In fact, we don't look at happiness. Other people have in great detail. There's a book by Richard Layard on happiness. But there are now a number of economists looking at the economics of happiness. You know, as people become more worried about whether GNP per capita, gross national income per capita, is really the most important goal of our societies, people have started thinking, well, we need other measures of well-being. And one of them, of course, is happiness. That usually is questionnaire data. But we wanted rather to choose things with fairly hard outcomes rather than simply opinions. And one or two of the things are opinion, like whether or not people feel they can trust others. But when you're talking about homicide rates or obesity or teenage birth rates, you know, that's hard data.
So you found pretty much across the board in countries like here in the U.S., the disparity between the rich and the poor is what factor is that roughly about? You said about 7 or 8 times difference?
Well, actually, we use the measure I described, the ratio of the top to bottom 20% internationally. But in American states, we use from the American census something called the Gini coefficient, which is a different but more complicated measure of inequality right across the population. We use that, again, simply because it's available. And we wanted to avoid people saying, well, they've done something funny in the calculations. So all the figures we wanted completely above board. I should mention, actually, that we were also worried that people would think we'd just chosen health or social problems that suit our argument. So we also looked at child well-being. UNICEF, the United Nations, has a measure of child well-being for rich countries. It contains 40 different components in every aspect of child well-being. So, for instance, whether kids can talk to their parents, whether there's bullying at school, how much they do, how well they do in the international maths and literacy tests, immunization rates, all sorts of aspects of child well-being go into it. And the advantage from our point of view is we didn't choose those components, but we find exactly the same pattern. Child well-being is very substantially determined, related to inequality, and remarkably unaffected by how rich or poor a country is. I mean, a country amongst the rich developed ones. So, you know, countries like the US and Norway are twice as rich as countries like Greece, Israel, Portugal, and yet that doesn't seem to affect child well-being. But the scale of income differences within each society has an enormous effect. So Norway has much smaller income differences than the US, and its children do much better. In Britain, our children do particularly badly. We have big income differences.
So, for all the factors you looked at, were you surprised when you kept finding?
Yes, in a way, I blame myself for having worked on the tendency for life expectancy to be better in more equal countries. I've worked on that, I don't know, for 20, 25 years. And gradually, I realized that there were a few criminologists who'd shown something similar for homicide rates, and I had got data showing that things like trust and social cohesion are better in more equal countries. But I didn't quickly make the jump to realizing that this applied to a whole lot of other social problems. I'm surprised I didn't, because I think many people, I mean, for hundreds of years, people have had an intuition that inequality is divisive and socially corrosive. And in a way, that's all the data shows. But it shows it, I think I imagined if inequality made any difference, that maybe if you could have a sort of perfectly utopian equal society, the kind of society that never exists, that you'd see it really was different. But most of us have to live in the real world, where there are big inequalities. I never imagined that the differences in inequality between different rich, developed market democracies would have such important differences in outcome. You know, like these huge differences in mental illness, teenage births, homicide, maths and literacy scores of kids. And it was realizing how big these effects were, how important they were, that made me just feel, I have to get this knowledge out, get people to understand it.
And did the form of government factor into this at all? Did you see any difference there?
Well, as I said, they are all market democracies. There are quite important differences between how countries become, well, in terms of the more equal ones. It's clear there are big government ways and small government ways of becoming more equal. For instance, at the most equal end are Sweden and Japan. Japan has, well, let's take Sweden first. It has very large differences in earnings. And they get their equality by redistributing through taxes and benefits. Japan, on the other hand, has much smaller differences in earnings to start with. They do less redistribution. They don't have such a big welfare state. And we find rather the same contrast amongst some of the more equal American states. New Hampshire, for instance, is one of the more equal states, and it has good outcomes in terms of these sorts of problems. But it, I think, has the lowest state taxation of any state except Alaska, and low social expenditure. So there are big government ways and small government ways of getting greater equality, and I suppose I was rather glad to find that, because the fear always, I suppose, is that it's only the more left governments that will do anything about taxes and benefits. But actually, on the political right, I think there are quite a number of people interested in local democracy and things like employee ownership and stuff like that, interested in small-scale local democracies, people taking charge of their own lives. And if you do that, by subjecting our work organizations to greater economic democracy and so on, I think that maybe you can rein in the sort of bonus culture which has existed only because most of us have had no say whatsoever in what people at the top get in our companies.
Yeah, it would seem that there's a lot of organizations out there that would be interested in your work. In supporting it. For instance, it was occurring to me while you're talking about the homicide rates being totally dependent on the inequality gap. It seems like the NRA would, here in the States, the gun rights group, mm-hmm. would be clinging to your book because it would show that, you know, gun proliferation in the U.S. has nothing to do with the homicide rate. It's the inequality gap.
It doesn't. Gun ownership has some influence. It's not as powerful as inequality. But Finland, for instance, although it's very equal, it has surprisingly high gun ownership, and it has had a number recently of these, you know, people just killing a few people before they kill themselves, those kinds of incidents. I think gun ownership does contribute to higher death rates. But it's not the overriding factor at all. I mean, I believe that Canada has a similar number of guns per head of population as the U.S., but much, much lower homicide. I've forgotten the other point I was going to make about that. Sorry.
So, talk about the impact that friendship has on one's health.
Yes, that's interesting. I mean, in relation to the sense that I think people have often had that inequality is divisive, and the evidence we now have that that's true, that involvement in community life falls away, that people trust each other less, that violence is more common in more unequal societies. Over the last 20 years or so, people have come to realize, working on the determinants of population health in the rich countries, that the quality of social relations is really important. It seems to work through chronic stress. I mean, people's levels of stress in the long run seem to affect the immune system, the cardiovascular system. And if you're chronically stressed over long periods, it makes you more vulnerable to a whole range of diseases, particularly and it looks a little bit like as if it speeds up the aging process. But it's interesting, it's not just observational studies where, you know, you look at people with friends or good relationships with their partners or people involved in community life and find they do better and you try and control for income and education and stuff like that. But people have also done experiments where, for instance, they make a little tiny puncture wound on the back of the hand of volunteers and measure how quickly it heals. And if you have a good relationship with your partner, it seems to heal faster than if you have a more stressful, difficult relationship. People have also done work where you give volunteers nasal drops with cold viruses in, and also get them to answer a questionnaire about the number of friends they have. And you find that from that same measured exposure to infection, people with few friends, people who are more isolated, are four times as likely to get colds. It's quite extraordinary, the importance of the social environment as a source of stress. And that seems to be one of the important reasons why health is worse in more unequal countries. It damages the quality of the social fabric, damages social cohesion.
Talk about the diseases that tend to hit the poor and changes countries and people within a country become more affluent.
Yes, that's an interesting process. We mention it in the book, but as countries get richer, the diseases of absolute poverty seem to fall away. So the big 19th century infectious diseases that used to be such important killers in childhood and amongst young people, not just amongst the elderly, those start to disappear. They remain important killers in the much poorer countries. But you also see that the diseases that we call the diseases of affluence, things like heart disease and so on, the degenerative diseases, cancers, become the diseases of the poor in affluent societies. You know, heart disease has been a rich man's disease. And throughout history, it's been the rich who've been fat and the poor who've been thin. That's reversed. And as countries get richer, those sorts of diseases reverse their social distribution and become more common at the bottom. But we are talking just about countries that have gone through that transition. Now our death rates are nearly all, very largely older people dying. We don't have those huge death rates we used to in infancy.
Could you also talk about, here in the U.S., of course, you're aware we're having a major healthcare debate. For lack of a better word, doesn't seem like too much debate to me. But healthcare expenditures here in the U.S. seem pretty high compared to the rest of the world, and yet our healthcare system, or at least what we get out of our healthcare system, doesn't really seem adequate.
Yes, people tend to think that healthcare, why we're healthier than we were a few generations ago, is because of modern medicine. That appears not to be true. Most of those great 19th century killers declined to a tiny fraction of what they were before medicine had anything to offer at all, before immunization, before treatment, and so on. If you look internationally at, for instance, at life expectancy in relation to medical expenditure or medical provision per head of population, you find no relationship. That doesn't really mean that medicine is pointless or ineffective. It just means that its effects are overshadowed by the power of the social and economic factors that I've been talking about. Basically more important than the treatment you get for cancer or heart disease is whether you get it in the first place. And there's such huge differences in how frequently these conditions occur in populations, that it overshadows the important contribution that medicine can make. But medicine is important in terms of the quality of life, dealing with hernias and cataracts and hip joints and stuff like that. Big, major contribution to the quality of life for many people, but maybe not a very big influence on death rates. And one of the reasons for that as well is that something like three quarters of all medical expenditure goes in your last year of life. So it can't have a very big effect on the length of your life.
So you have pulled all this data together and gotten some outstanding reviews from people who one would anticipate might be critics of your work, both like The Economist and The Financial Times give you praise.
Yes, we've been rather surprised what an easy ride we've had. I think The Economist said that the evidence was hard to dispute, sort of grudging approval, I suppose. But one of the things I haven't said that I think is important is that inequality seems to increase status competition. You know, if the differences between the people at the top and bottom are bigger, then we seem to judge people more by social status, and where you are becomes even more important. So status competition and inequality drive consumerism. And basically, I think people know that consumerism is pretty hollow. I mean, surveys show that something like 75% or 80% of the population think of consumerism as involving a sacrifice of more important human values, and they often mention friends and family and community and stuff like that. We're driven by this sort of force that people don't understand, which actually is extraordinarily socially destructive.
Certainly so here in the U.S. So what do you hope to accomplish with this book, and what, if you were put in charge of the U.S., the appropriate programs here in the U.S. for expenditures or whatever, what would you do?
Well, when I say that the different ways of increasing equality, I think we need to use them all. So taxes and benefits is part of it. The danger is that they can be undone by the next government that comes in. I think we need to get a more equal structure, more deeply rooted in our societies, through all sorts of forms, almost any form of greater economic and workplace democracy, by which I mean having more mutuals, more friendly societies, more employee ownership, more cooperatives, more employee representatives on the board. Because as I said at the beginning, I think that the bonus culture, the way the rich have run away from the rest of us over the last 20 years, that's why the gap in incomes has widened so much, has been possible only because they are completely unaccountable to other people, to the employees in their company, and they've often given themselves these bonuses while laying off people or holding down wage demands lower in the company. That's simply a lack of any kind of economic democracy. And interestingly, people say that if a company goes to employee buyout, it changes it from being a piece of property to a community. It's at work that wealth is not only created, but that it's divided up and the inequalities are created. It's also where we're most subjected to authority, you know, to hierarchy with bosses and, you know, the underlings and all that.
We are talking with Richard Wilkinson. He is co-author, along with Kate Pickett, of the new book, The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Stronger. And you are also a co-founder of the Equality Trust. Can you briefly tell us what that is?
Yes, we started it, about a year ago, simply because we felt we were sitting on something much more important than I'd ever thought I'd find after a career in research, and we just had to get it out there. So we have a website, www.equalitytrust.org.uk. We were given some funding from a Quaker charity in the UK, the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust. And now we're getting contributions as well from other people. We're very small, but you can download some of the slides and pick up some useful stuff, so do visit it. And basically, it is just to make this kind of evidence better known. And I think it's really important, particularly in relation to the changes we're going to have to make faced with climate change and reducing carbon emissions. It feeds into that, too.
That was Richard Wilkinson, co-author of The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Society Stronger, interviewed by Mike McCormick, who is the interviewer in the next segment also.
We are talking today with Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman, who started in radio in 1968, is the host of a national daily progressive radio talk show available on XM and Sirius Satellite Radio. He is the four-time Project Censored award-winning New York Times best-selling author of 19 books currently in print in over a dozen languages. His most recent books are We the People, A Call to Take Back America, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, and he is here to talk about his new book, Threshold, The Crisis of Western Culture. Tom, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me here, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Start out and tell us what was the motivation in writing your book, Threshold, The Crisis of Western Culture.
Well, first of all, I have three children, and I think that there's a certain sense of obligation to the future. You know, the old, what's often attributed as a Native American saying that we borrow this planet from our children. And I think that our culture has kind of reversed that. You know, we're gonna use it however we damn well please, and they can fend for themselves. That was probably part of it. Part of it is that, It was just making me crazy that I am constantly hearing people nibbling around the edges with regard to both the problems and the solutions. Global warming is not the problem. Pollution is not the problem. Carbon dioxide is not the problem. Overpopulation is not the problem. Those are all problems, but they are symptoms of a much larger problem. And the much larger problem is the one that's untouchable. It's the one that's unspeakable. It's the one you will never hear about on network news or in corporate television. The real problem is our culture. We have a dysfunctional culture. A culture is a set of assumptions, a set of stories that we all collectively tell ourselves about who we are, where we came from, where we're going, what our relation to each other is, what our relation to the world is, what our relation to economies and politics and technology, all of those things, all of that stuff makes up our culture. And it finds expression in how we live, how we speak, how we conduct ourselves, everything that we do. And our culture says we must grow. Right, that we must have an economics of growth. Our culture says that it's entirely appropriate for a corporation to have the rights of a human being. Our culture says that patriarchy and hierarchy are the natural ways of things, and in fact natural to humanity. Science, by the way, contradicts both of those things. Our culture says that to internalize profits and externalize costs for a power plant not to have to, or an oil company not to have to pay for the millions of cancers that they're creating every year and the damage that they're doing to the environment, but instead just walk away with the profits and leave the rest of us to pay for that's just fine. And so, you know, at the very macro level, there are some very large cultural assumptions that we have failed at. One, that everything is sacred. We instead, as a culture, have been assuming that the sacred is found in a box that we go to on Sundays or Saturdays or Fridays. And the consequence of that is that because nothing is sacred, we feel, you know, perfectly willing to screw it up, right? Because it's not sacred, you know. And if there is something that's sacred, that's something sacred, you know, with the famous James Watt saying from the Reagan administration when he was asked why he was willing to sell off Western lands at literally a penny an acre to big mining companies that were going to pull thousands of dollars an acre worth of materials out of them. Of course, his later consulting company did very well with that. And he said, oh, well, Jesus is coming back and he'll make all things new. I mean, these kinds of bizarre cultural assumptions, this is at the heart of the problem that we're facing. And nobody was confronting them. And so I wanted to write a book and say, the problem. It's our culture, stupid, you know, kind of thing. You know, this is the real problem. It's how we think. It's not what we're doing. What we're doing is obviously some terrible problems, but we wouldn't be doing them if we weren't thinking that way.
It seems one of the sacred things we do have, we do focus on, is the worship of the dollar and the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Put that above all else.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, this whole thing of, you know, free markets has been raised to a religion, the religion of the free market. There's no such thing as a free market. It's like saying, let's have a free football game, right? No goalposts, no yard lines, no referees, no rules. You know, that's not football. You know, let's have a free baseball game. You know, one team can have, you know, they don't have to touch first. They can go straight to second. I mean, what? Markets have rules. We define the purpose of a marketplace. Just as one example, you know, there's many. We define the purpose of a marketplace. And historically, one of the things that separated the United States from European countries when we were started was that we were following the Enlightenment track. We were the founders of this country were big students of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you know, the noble savage, and John Locke, you know, life, liberty, and the right to private property, actually, is what which was a heretical notion in 1635 when he was writing that, because the king owned everything. And even had the right to sleep with the bride on the first night in many countries, even still at that time. So the founders had this idea that wealth and land and power wasn't the sacred stuff, that the relationship between us was the sacred stuff, that, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, not that everybody can get rich, but that everybody has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, the Declaration of Independence was the first founding document in any country in the history of the world to have the word happiness in it. And these were people who saw much of the world as sacred. I mean, using that word very advisedly, and not in a box. You know, when Jefferson first wrote, you know, Nature's God, he's got Nature's God at the Declaration of Independence, and John Adams and Ben Franklin edited that thing over a 2-day period, and you can see the original. Adams scratched out Nature's God and put the Christian God, and Jefferson scratches out the Christian God and puts no Nature's God, you know, because this was nature. And now we're finding out, and there's a study that I cite in the book Threshold about how with deer, the original study was done, but with all animals, from insects to primates, decisions are made democratically. They're not, virtually all animal societies are not organized hierarchically, except with regard to sex. That's it. The study with the alpha deer, for example, or with the red deer and the alpha deer, I thought was particularly fascinating. Done at the University of Essex, and you know, they had this herd of deer, and they put on these cameras in the trees and a couple of drinking holes nearby. And how do they know when to know which drinking hole to go to? I mean, these are actually important decisions, because if they go too soon, some members don't get enough nutrients. If they wait too long, some might get dehydrated. They've got to account for young and old. I mean, there's all these variables. So how do they know? Well, the assumption was the alpha deer would make the decision. After all, he fought himself bloody every spring to become the alpha deer. But it turns out that as the appropriate time to go get a drink comes, different deer start pointing their bodies in the direction of one of the three watering holes. And when 51% of them are pointing at one of the watering holes, within about a 4-minute period, the entire herd will form and move in that direction. And very often the alpha deer's in the back going, hey, where'd everybody go? And it's democratic. And then they said, okay, so how can we force the alpha deer to come out, you know, to assert his leadership? And so they put a predator near one of the watering holes. So now 50% comes and goes. Deer aren't moving. They're going, aha, the alpha deer is going to come out. You know, 52%, 53%, 55%, 60%, still no action. They're waiting for the alpha deer, 63%, 4, 5, 6. When they hit 66%, a 2/3 majority of the deer pointing at one of the watering holes, boom, off goes the herd, a supermajority. It's wired into our, and very often the alpha deer again is in the back going, where did everybody go? It's wired into our DNA. Democracy's in our DNA. You see a flock of birds flying through the sky, and all of a sudden they turn No, entire flock. It's not like the lead one turns and the rest of them move. It's not like you know, you're looking at a freight train. It's like they all move at the same time. I used to think, how do they do that? They've got to be telepathic, right? Schools of fish, you know, boom, 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 left, right. How do they do that? Turns out that after this research on the deer was published in Nature, I interviewed the scientists, Roper and Conrad, on this stuff. They started getting all these correspondences from ichthyologists and ornithologists and entomologists and all the people in all these different disciplines that were genus-specific or species-specific or whatever it is. I've forgotten my table, kingdom, phylum, whatever, who were saying, you know, we're doing like slow-motion photography and we're discovering that the school of fish, for example, you know, as they swim, they move left to right, you know, 3 degrees left, 3 degrees right, 3 degrees left, 3 degrees right. But you know, there's always outliers. There's always fish who are moving like 4 degrees left and then back 3 degrees right and 4 degrees left, you know, and they're like trying to vote for left. Well, when 51% of them move that extra 1 degree to the left, the entire school moves a degree to the left. They have very, very fast peripheral vision. And they're all voting with every motion of their body. So this is an entire society that's voting maybe 100 times a minute. It's a democracy. I remember as a little kid watching a swarm of gnats. And they were just, it's like this ball of gnats. I was sitting by this little creek near my house, you know, and just looking for crayfish and playing. I was 7 years old. And I still remember as if it was yesterday, this ball of gnats in the air just going, and it would just hover there, and then all of a sudden, it would move about 3 feet off, you know, to the distance. And there'd be maybe a dozen gnats left behind going, where'd everybody go? They were probably the alpha gnats, right? And where'd everybody go? It turns out it's a democratic decision-making process. Even with ants, even with the highly social animals, they make decisions democratically. There's no leader. The only benefit that the alpha deer gets for all that bloody head beating that he goes through is that he gets first choice of sexual partner, which is perfectly consistent with Darwinian evolution. That makes perfect sense. The strongest animal has the first opportunity to reproduce. But in terms of the survival of the entire herd on a day-to-day basis with regard to decision-making, it's got nothing to do with the alpha animal in any species.
So it seems as a species we have completely disconnected ourselves from that innate ability to democratically make choices.
To a large extent, since Gilgamesh, since Sumeria, for about 7,000 years, we have embraced patriarchy and hierarchy. But the fact of the matter is, when I say we, I'm talking about our culture. This, you know, thus the subtitle, The Crisis of Western Culture. Because if you look at the Yanomami, or if you look at the Iroquois Confederacy, where in 5 out of the 6 Iroquois nations, men were not even allowed to vote. They were matrilineal, matriarchal societies where women made the decisions. Men, the sachems, made the visits. They made the journeys. They traveled from community to community to carry out the decisions. But the women voted. And what you find is that in these societies that they're highly egalitarian, they're highly small-d democratic, and things work. The women voting part I want to point to and focus on. It's kind of a digression, but population. You know, up to this point we've been talking about economics and democracy, and I was saying, you know, our assumptions about democracy are wrong, our assumptions about economics are wrong. There's no such thing as a free market, and democracy actually is in our DNA. Kingdoms and hierarchy are an aberration. Population, the world population at the time of Christ was 250 million people, 250 million people. That was a high point. I mean, it took 165,000 years of humans spreading all over the earth, literally all over the earth, to reach 250 million people. By the year 1000, we were at 500 million people. Finally, in 1800, we hit 1 billion people. So 165,000 years to get us to 1 billion people, and arguably millions of years. But, I mean, the oldest fully Homo sapiens fossils, 165. The second billion didn't take 165,000 years. It took 130 years, 1930. The third billion only took 30 years, 1960. The fourth billion took only 14 years, 1974. The fifth billion took only 13 years, 1987. The sixth billion took only 11 years, 1999. We're now working on our seventh billion people. It's amazing to think that the day that Franklin Roosevelt was sworn into office If two out of three of the people around us, if two-thirds of the entire, all everybody on Earth were to vanish, the population would still be greater than it was on Earth when Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in. If six out of seven people were to vanish from the Earth right now, or five out of six, argue five out of six and a half were to vanish right now, there would be more people than there were on the Earth at the time that this continent was being colonized by the Europeans. I mean, it's, and the world was not lightly populated at that time. So the question is, why is this population explosion, which is arguably the primary driver for all these other ills, why is this happening? And up until recently, the assumptions have been that it's either economically driven or it is technologically driven. The technological driver, or restrainer, actually, is birth control. You know, the assumption that if only there was more birth control around. If only, you know, every third world country had bubble gum machines on every corner with birth control pills, and you didn't even have to put a penny in; they were just free. If only we could airdrop condoms by the thousands, you know, every month. Well, it turns out the birth control, lack of access to birth control, is a very real problem around the world, particularly in the third world. But it's not the problem, because there are societies. The Middle Eastern ones are the ones that we're probably most familiar with, the oil-rich nations, where there are no cultural or religious proscriptions against birth control. It's easily and widely available, and yet still typical family size is 10. You know, women are having 11, 12, 13 children, or less, but the average family size is 10. So it's not technology that's causing the problem. Then the economists come along, the Paul Wolfowitzes of the world. You know, they say, oh yeah, the problem's economic, because what you see is that when countries reach a certain level of economic wealth, they seem to go to zero population growth. I mean, look at Italy; they're in negative population growth right now, the home of the Vatican, ironically, and they actually have the highest compliance, the highest rate of birth control usage of any country in Europe. Italy, I love that stat. Anyway, so. Their suggestion then is, let's raise the standard of living of everybody in the world to the kind of European middle class, or maybe poverty level, but, you know, or American poverty level. Americans, our median income is $44,000 a year, and our poverty level is $14,500. Let's get everybody up to $14,500. Well, consider half of the almost 7 billion people on the planet live on less than $5 a day. To get all of them to that standard of living would require the natural resources of four planet Earths. It's physically impossible. Secondly, it doesn't matter, because in those countries that have become rich and have not changed their cultures, those countries, for example, again, the Middle Eastern countries, you find, you know, there are countries where you get $20,000 a year simply for being a citizen. You know, it's just like what Sarah Palin does up in Alaska. Take the oil revenue, cut a check to everybody every year. She's just a small-time socialist. These are big-time socialists, you know, they write big checks. And still, the families are, you know, got 8 to 10 kids, and the populations are exploding, and they don't know, you know, the Saudis don't know what to do with all the people, and it's, you know, fill in the blanks. Turns out that the one variable that is absolutely solid, the one thing that defines whether a culture is going through population explosion or not, is the relationship, the power relationship between men and women. When women have relatively equal power with men, in a single generation, population will stabilize. And when women are the property of men, invariably you have population explosion. The fact of the matter is that the story that we've been telling ourselves, that the human population, the human race went to 1 billion in 1800, 2 billion in 1930, 3 billion in the population, that's the story of the human race? False. That's the story of our culture. Because there are 1,000 other cultures on Earth that have been population stable for 10,000 years, 20,000 years, 30,000 years. In the case of the San in northern South Africa, the Bushmen of the Kalahari, 60,000 years, population stable. It's an egalitarian society. Women have equal power with men. So, in a very real way, you can say, you know, geez, we've got these terrible problems, the world is melting around us, we're all going to die, blah, 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 what do? Change the way we think. And so it's like what Greg Mortensen is doing in Pakistan, where he's going into, he wrote Three Cups of Tea, where he's going into these communities and he's building schools for girls, And now the women are empowered in the communities, and guess what's happening? They're throwing the Taliban out. They're saying, you know, we don't need this stinking stuff. They're embracing more moderate forms of Islam that are less hierarchical, less violent, and less patriarchal, and that are more embracing, just like Christianity has kind of gone through a reformation, and the United Church of Christ embraces everybody, but we've still got some Christian fundamentalists out there who say that, you know, women should sit in the back of the church and shut up. And by coincidence, they tend to have 8 kids in their families. So, anyhow, I'm ranting a bit. You get the point.
So what do you see then as concrete solutions? I mean, obviously we have to change the way we think, but mm-hmm. how do we do that as a society that's as large as ours is?
I think changing the way people think is a lot easier than we realize. Because when people get something, when they learn something, it's very hard to unlearn it. And if it's something that is not only intuitively true, not only logically true, but is actually true, you know, the story of democracy being in our DNA, which is why all tribal people throughout history, and in the book I tell the story of the Maori in New Zealand who ate the last moa bird on the island. I mean, they led to their own starvation, and they devolved into warfare and famine and, you know, this violent, violent society, and that Abel Tasman discovered, in quotes, and they even ate 3 of his sailors, and he sailed off. He was horrified and continued on then Captain Cook 40 years later came along, and he continued on past New Zealand and discovered British New Caledonia, which was another 1,000 miles in the direction of Hawaii, where the same Melanesian people, only 3,000 years earlier rather than 800 years earlier, had occupied an island that was covered with the same moa birds. These are birds that are like 200 pounds, and you can walk up to them, break their necks, and you got a week's worth of food. And they ate all of them, and they were reduced to eating rats, like the people in New Zealand, like the Maori were. But no Europeans showed up, and they had to figure out how to work it out, and they couldn't leave the island, and they got nothing left, and they destroyed most of the edible fauna and flora, and they'd killed all the seals. And what they figured out was small-d democracy, and they reinvented their societies, an egalitarian, matriarchal, matrilineal society. And when Captain Cook arrived there, now those people, the Maori had only had 200 years, you know, just a couple generations of the horror of famine. And so they were still in the midst of the trying to figure it out stage. The New Caledonians were 1,000 years past that. And we're already into, okay, we've made the change, just as most of the native societies in North America had. And many of the African communities had as well, by the way. I mean, these were the stories that were coming back to France in the 1600s that caused Rousseau to write about the noble savage. And Captain Cook said, this is the most perfect and wonderful society, surely, that has ever existed on Earth. I mean, he was just blown away by it. He just wanted to stay there for the rest of his life. You know, he ended up, you know, dying in Hawaii just up the road, but, you know, he was just, his diaries about New Caledonia and several other societies that had reached that point read very much like the diaries of first contact of some of the early Americans, you know, with Native American societies when they had contact with these egalitarian societies. So I think that waking people up, you know, the work isn't so much, gee, we've got to do this. Is once people are awake, it gets done. It was like 30 years ago, nobody knew what global warming was. And now we've got the world mobilizing. Might be a little late, maybe not. We'll see. But the fact of the matter is, once you've seen Al Gore's movie, you can't go back.
So you have hope then that we can turn this around at this point?
I have tremendous hope, because what history shows us is that human society after human society has crashed and burned, and come back after the crash and burn in ways that are not toxic. It has happened repeatedly. In fact, it's happened for virtually every human society that's not functioning in a toxic way. I have a lot of hope. And, you know, the democracy's in our DNA, that we're, you know, we're wired for this. If we can just avoid destroying ourselves, if we can just avoid that, excuse me, I think we'll make it through fine.
Well, that's, and that's quite the trick at this point in time in history.
It is. It is. Although it also may be, you know, we may be thinking too highly of ourselves. I mean, it's back when Paul Ehrlich in the early 1970s wrote The Population Bomb, he predicted that millions of people would die of starvation, famine would increase, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, people poo-pooed it. And even now you'll find people saying, ah, that Paul Ehrlich, he was nuts, he was wrong. Fact of the matter is he was right. It just didn't happen in the United States. It's happening in the third world all around the world. And it's happening particularly in those societies that adopted our culture and discarded their local culture. I start the book in Darfur. We were in Darfur a year ago, March, and on the border of Darfur in South Sudan, in a refugee community of 45,000 people with one well and one latrine. And it was originally a little town of 6,000 people, and I was talking to this young Dinka man. Dinkas are the local tribe, the local black Africans who are being overrun by the light-skinned Arab Africans from the north who are coming down, and that's the genocide that's happening in between North and South Sudan, and Darfur is kind of in the middle. It's actually off to the side, but, you know, politically in the middle. And he could name, he could tell me the Dinka names of some of the plants. I mean, we were surrounded, even though we were in a desert, we were surrounded by life. You know, it wasn't abundant in the dry season, but it was there. But he didn't know the healing properties of them. He knew that his ancestors knew. He knew that his, you know, I mean, this is a place where there's some of the most god-awful diseases on earth. And yet people have been living there for 165,000 years. His ancestors knew that, you know, quinquina bark would cure malaria. But he didn't know that. Right? So he came out of a culture that was perfectly adapted to that environment, to survival in that environment, and actually even life is good in that environment. And we came along with colonial activity over a 150-year period and imposed on them a culture that was ideally suited for industrial society and cities. Yet we were standing in a part of Africa where the nearest paved road was 400 miles away. And the nearest electricity was 400 miles away. I mean, literally, the nearest place you could plug something in was 400 miles away. And so our culture didn't, it was not at all useful to them. I mean, what they were left with was this little Presbyterian missionary group who had brought in one doctor, and they'd go and, you know, people get sick and they'd all pray to Jesus. They had forgotten the plants. They had forgotten the, you know, I mean, it was all gone. And so the point in my book, again, just to kind of summarize it and threshold the crisis of Western culture, is that the crisis that we're at a series of thresholds, a series of doors that are open, you know, a series of door sills here, or sills, and we could step across them into the abyss, or we can step across them into a better world. And if we inform ourselves properly, we can make it a better world. And doing that requires us to learn the lessons of history that we're probably uniquely able to have, unlike many of our predecessors. You know, when Rome fell, the Romans weren't able to look back at 35 other societies plus maybe 200 indigenous societies and say, what lessons can we learn? We can.
In addition to your book, Threshold, The Crisis of Western Culture, do you have a website people can turn to?
TomHartmann.com is the website, you know, mostly for my radio show and for my books. All my books are there, and there's a couple hundred articles that I've written and things like that. Yeah, so there's a lot of resources there.
Author and radio host Tom Hartmann, interviewed by Mike McCormick.